I have an hour and a half tonight, and what I'm going to try to do is run through the humility material quicker, because now that I've gotten to know you all, I feel like you know this already. You know what I'm lecturing to the choir. Thank you. So I'm going to run through it fast so I can answer some questions.
Okay, teacher.
Okay. Some of you have already given me questions that I want to answer because they're great questions. So we're going to start off with, and I hear that these handouts are going to be put up on the APA website, not the ACA website. I think I'm back at the Psychological Association. And we're going to put them up on our website, too, so you'll always have access to them and so that you can tell your friends where to look. And on the first handout that you got this morning, which is in that packet, I think I only used one handout this morning, but on the bottom of it is both of our websites, our email addresses, if you want to email us to ask us any questions, and our phone number, if you know of anybody or if you're interested to bring us to your town to talk, because we love to do that, okay? So email us if you have questions. Go to our website because it's loaded with information. It's loaded with lots of articles that we've written. And the Barbara Whitfield website even has tapes that you can download and listen to. I want to start off with this. I want to start off with this handout. I think it's on the back. I'm not sure exactly where it is. But it's the process of recovery. And I just did this a couple weeks ago. It's interesting how as we got ready to come here, Charlie and I got all these new ideas and did these overheads. I'm sorry. I think they're all gone. Can anybody share? This is my idea of how I see recovery, and it might be a little bit different from Charlie's, but after doing after being a group leader for 11 years and observing what goes on in groups, I did this, and actually the center part was just the bridge. That's how we move through recovery. It looks very short in this picture. It should be, 3 to 5 years long? I don't know. But healing over time, and this is the actual bridge of healing. Humility encompasses the whole thing, and humility is what I'm going to be defining in a couple minutes. And when we go into recovery, not with all of these, but some of these, with age regressions, flashbacks, abreactions, or numbness, emotional pain, inability to trust, frequent drama, and projecting out a lot of stuff, always projecting out danger, because we grew up with danger, so we see danger everywhere. So we start telling our story, and we're in ACA support groups. If we choose trauma-based group therapy, and I think group therapy is without a doubt one of the finest tools for healing, much more than individual. And with it, bibliotherapy, reading the books. And that moves us into the healing process. This is what I really wanted to point out. This is what we need in order to get through. We need humility, obviously. And we need a little bit of hope when we start, just a little bit. Even just the idea that maybe we could have hope starts us in a program. And then we have to name and grieve our hurts, losses, and traumas. I'm not saying blaming, I'm saying naming, okay? We have to identify our needs. Wow, do we have needs? We have to identify what we need and practice getting them met with safe people. We have to name and work through our core issues. We have to learn to tolerate emotional pain. And then we have to start opening up, especially this is great in group therapy and ACA, we have to start hearing other people and their pain, which moves us into compassion. Here's one where a lot of our patients get stuck. Releasing our drama. Getting over all the drama. And being able to see it a little bit differently so we're not constantly pumping out adrenaline. And then we discover and practice being our real self. And the payoff is compassion and reframing our emotional pain so we don't have to keep going through pain all the time. we can start reframing it. Somebody asked me about reframing this morning, and I couldn't come up with an example. I was having a senior moment, and then a perfect example popped up while we were having lunch. Somebody came up to me and said, "They're sold out of your books." I said, "Oh, that's terrible." And then somebody else said, "No, it's great. They've sold out your books." So that's a reframe. Taking something that we thought was terrible and giving it a whole different outlook. You know, we're starting to change our perception of reality. So we reframe and we work with compassion. And what we get is we can recognize when we're in our false self, and we can recognize when we're in our true self. And that's, life becomes easier to manage. We practice surrender and letting go. We start getting new insights. We name and own our projections. We live in the present. We have a new sense of reality. And finally, we get some peace. Now, I heard some people talking earlier about being happy. When are we going to be happy? Let's get happy. You know, this whole goal is happy. And I had to rethink happy for myself. And what I realized was peace. Happy comes and happy goes with whatever's going on in our life. Sometimes something great is happening and we're happy, and then that goes. But can we get back to peace? So to me, the goal is learning how to be peaceful, accepting peace in our lives. And this whole mechanism here is what brings the peace. And I can't underline enough that the humility is underlying all of it. Okay, now, Charlie's not around. I'm going to have to do this machine myself. Sorry. Okay. The next handout that you have that I want to go over quickly, I don't have an overhead, and it's called Healing Low Self-Esteem with Humility. One of my patients recently said to me, "You got to help me heal my low self-esteem. I need high self-esteem." And it was interesting. He did it a couple weeks ago, and that's when I came up with this one. That's why I don't even have an overhead yet. But when I thought about it more and more, remember when we used to think that hate was the opposite of love? But hate, we found out hate really isn't the opposite of love. Fear is. Fear is the opposite of love. And I was thinking about it, and I was thinking, high self-esteem is not the opposite of low self-esteem. Humility is the opposite of low self-esteem. High self-esteem can be a double-edged sword. It can turn out to be ego inflation. It's a head trip. We've decided we need high self-esteem, and we start telling ourselves all the affirmations. But I know a lot of my patients have said to me, these affirmations have worn out. They're just not working anymore. And the affirmation kind of high self-esteem is a head trip. It's not a heart experience. It can also be a spiritual bypass. So the reason why I'm putting humility on the other end of the continuum from low self-esteem is that when we have true humility, and the way I'm defining humility here is not being a doormat. I'm defining humility as the willingness and the openness to learn more about myself, to learn more about my relationship with others, and to learn more about my relationship with a higher power. When we adapt that, it neutralizes the low self-esteem, because instead of us being bonded to our pity party, we get to start opening up and learning more about ourselves. We have to give up putting ourselves down and start learning about how to lift ourselves up. That's humility. So to me, humility is the opposite of low self-esteem. We understand that our empowerment comes from a higher power, and that we're in partnership with that higher power. In other words, we're learning more about our relationship with higher power. And if we do that, higher power is helping us to get out of our low self-esteem. So that the next thing I said was, to accept healing from a higher power, we need humility, not perfection. Higher power is not waiting for us to be perfect. Human beings are not perfect. But with humility, we can get some healing. Our sense of low self-esteem, which is a code phrase for shame, our sense of low self-esteem or shame is born, bred, and nourished in our ego, not our soul, and not our child within. And then the other thing I thought of was that our souls are made in the image of God, or the image of higher power. So how could we not be worthy? And if this is hard for you to take in, then I would ask you to take this home with you and sit down and read it again, breathing into your heart. And when we breathe into our heart, like we did this morning using our heart, just sit with it and think about humility and think about that each one of us is a reflection of God. And then don't answer yourself in words. Just feel what's going on in your heart. I tried this with a couple patients, and it really did work, and I've used it with myself. If we just think about ourselves through our heart instead of through our head, we can have an experiential understanding of humility and of not needing, being able to get let go of our low self-esteem. It's not an option anymore to carry around low self-esteem. Part of our healing is giving it up. Okay. Charlie asked me to show you this one on humility. I'm going to get into defining humility in a minute. But you don't have this in your handouts. I just want you to see it. This is recovery. Humility increases with recovery. When we start off, when we have some kind of active problem, there's no humility. But early, somewhere early in recovery, it starts clicking in that we're in recovery to learn more about ourselves. And when we're learning more about ourselves, that's humility. So as we move through recovery, and I'm going to show you the levels in a few minutes, this is our recovery over time. It keeps increasing. Okay, let's get into how we defined humility. This is a book that we came out with last year. This is all from this book. 5 years ago, another couple who have several spiritual communities all over the world brought us a map. You going to take that? Brought us a map of humility, that I'm going to show you in a few minutes. And we didn't know what to make of it, but we agreed to write a book about it, because when I show you the map, you'll understand. It's a one-page map of transcendence. It's a one-page map of healing, but it's not done alone. I know a lot of our ACA work is done alone. This is for couples and for everyone to learn how to function and spiritually evolve in relationship to other people. So the first thing we did was try to define what traits we need. And you've got this in your handouts. And we came up with 12 traits and then two more of what humility is comprised of. The first characteristic, basic to humility, is openness. I heard people talking this morning about a shift in paradigm. You know, before recovery, we have one paradigm going, and it's the paradigm of our family of origin. And once we move into recovery, we become open to new ways, a new paradigm. So it's this openness. Without this openness, we can't even begin to start defining humility. An attitude of don't know. Remember I said this morning that when I meditate, if I can move into my don't know mind, my ego quiets down. Ego knows everything. True self, child within, soul, doesn't know. That's another big trait. And then there's curiosity. Aren't you all curious? Curious about your own recovery? Curious about how different you're going to feel when you leave here? How you felt when you came in and you were just totally open to hearing what we had to say? That's curiosity. And then there's innocence. It gets to a point as we drop the old belief system that we start to feel innocent. Some people talk about it as feeling raw, like they have no boundaries and they have to learn how to protect themselves. There's an innocence that's happened where we're not being defensive anymore, where we're just open. And with that innocence, we need healthy boundaries. But that innocence, that second innocence that Jesus talked about, is an incredible way to walk around. And includes a childlike nature. I mean, we practiced playing last night. I've heard a lot of laughter today. That's our childlike nature coming out. This is a safe place, and we can be childlike. And spontaneous. Totally different than, what's the opposite of spontaneous? Impulsive. So we're not being impulsive. We're not trying to push something through because we think we're supposed to. Spontaneity comes from that childlike nature. Spirituality, a direct experience. our own experience that nobody else can tell us about, only we can feel it ourselves, our spiritual relationship with the higher power. I switch these two around. Patience comes before tolerance because patience teaches us tolerance. And of course, to be in this program, we've got to have some patience. It doesn't happen overnight. But as it's happening, we become more tolerant of our own imperfections. In fact, I think after a while, they become kind of cute. We can start loving ourselves just the way we are. We become tolerant. And automatically, an integrity comes out. Integrity means wholeness. All of us starts functioning together. We agree. And somewhere in all of that, in order to survive out in the world, we have to detach. We really were never in control to begin with. The only thing we're really in control of is ourselves. So somewhere in all of this, we detach from needing to control or needing to get other people to understand where we're at. And finally, we let go. The detachment can be inner or outer process. The letting go is outer. After we did these 12, and we wrote a chapter on them, I said, hey, what about gratitude? If we can walk around functioning like this all the time, gratitude, what gratitude? And I've heard gratitude all day today. Gratitude is such an important part of what's going on this whole weekend. And I have to tell you, the way I experience gratitude for myself and from other people, it's the same vibration as love. When we put ourselves in gratitude, we are vibrating love. And, I mean, if you're alone and you're looking to be with other people, just to have a grateful attitude will pull people in because you feel loving. And if you don't want to pull people in, just tuck your gratitude away. This one I had so much trouble with. I mean, I must have argued with Charlie about this one for weeks. It's called being nobody special. You know, we worked so hard to get our healing underway and to figure out who we are. And I understand that in the first developmental stages of life, we need to be somebody special. But what I finally got to after weeks of resisting this is that when we're somebody special, we are totally attached to our ego. And our ego is spinning out these tales all the time of how special we are. And when we decide to be nobody special, our egos can quiet down. Our false self can rest. And it's just so wonderful to not have to defend who we are. To just be nobody special. So this is, I think, the second or third chapter in our humility book. Now we're going to get to the meat. This is the map that was handed to us by Jyoti and Russell Park, who are our co-authors. There was none of the side stuff when they gave it to us. It was just these four triangles. And what they said was this bottom triangle, which is where humankind has been knocking around since the beginning of our time, is conflict. And this is called the Karpman Triangle, and it's been written about a lot in psychology. It's in a lot of psychology books. Karpman was a researcher who went along with police on their calls when it was domestic violence. And Karpman walked in and watched what went on in hundreds of these calls. And somebody was getting beaten up. Whether it was the husband or wife, who knows. But somebody was getting beaten up. So somebody was the victim, and somebody was the abuser. So here's the victim, and here's the persecutor. And the police would come in as the rescuer. And guess what? Within 5 minutes, the police were either the victims or they were the persecutor. Because whoever was getting beaten up turned around and was defending the abuser and blaming the police. That's the Karpman Triangle. And they brought us this and they said, you know, this is what can happen when we start to wake up. This is what can happen when our consciousness level shifts, when we start to evolve. And then they left us with this. We spent a week talking about it. And then Charlie and I spent the next 5 years going over how could we explain this in a book form. Now, to be very honest with you, that 5 years that we worked on this book improved our relationship incredibly. Because as we were trying to get this and trying to explain it in a simplified form, we were practicing it. And it was amazing. It was absolutely amazing to sit there feeling like I'm a victim and ready to blame him and go, wait a minute, I'm down in level one where it's either I'm right or he is. What if I just try moving up to the second level, which is both and, where both of us can be empowered? And I wound up sitting down and writing a case study from one of our patients in group who had just done this. You know the synchronicity? We're about to write about moving to level two, and she popped up with this story in one of our groups. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to read you one page, because she could say it better than I can. Her name is Sandra. She's a 55-year-old adult child of an alcoholic, and she's been in recovery with us for 4 years. She has 3 married children and is in a second marriage of 10 years. She told our psychotherapy group after she and her husband returned from a 10-day visit that to see two of her children and their families in another state. Now, this is a quote from her to the group. "My husband and I were together constantly for several days and spontaneously started to argue as we walked into my son's house. My grandson and son were standing there, and it was quite embarrassing, but we couldn't stop snapping at each other. After several minutes, I said I was going shopping with my grandson, and my husband took off with my son, who said as we were all leaving, 'I'm convinced that all couples fight, and it's no big deal.' She said, I could feel my embarrassment fade away, and I started to examine my anger at my husband. I knew we had been together too much, or much more than we are used to. I spent the rest of the day with my kids trying to stay away from him, but not being obvious. Driving back to our motel, I looked at him and again replayed in my mind what he had said and how he looked when I snapped at him. I remembered our discussions in group about the feelings that are painful boiling up from our unresolved anger from when we were kids. My anger at the moment we snapped at each other was much bigger than what was going on between us, and it felt like we were both out of control. I felt a tinge of compassion for him. I know his family background and suddenly realized how much pain he must have been in to snap at me like that. In a moment of humility, I made a conscious decision not to focus on my anger and to focus instead on my compassion for him. When we got back to the motel, I told him about that, and he then told me why he had snapped at me. It wasn't the mean reason I originally believed, and so I told him why I got angry back. He didn't know I felt that way either. We talked it out, making sure we listened and believed each other's reasons. We ended up embracing and saying how much we love each other and even expressed how we wanted to walk through the rest of this lifetime together. I think the whole situation turned around for me when my son said all couples fight, which removed my embarrassment and got me grounded. My son did not try to rescue us, although I believe his action was the beginning of some motivation to change our bickering into something better. Later, we became empowered instead of rotating the roles of victim and persecutor. It was an important experience of learning not to focus on anger. We have choices now. If we just look carefully at the people we love, we can allow the compassion in our hearts to well up and help us shift away from anger into something that is much more better for us all. That's Sandra's story. So she was able to move up from conflict to what we call co-commitment. And I would say in this one, both of them were empowered. We're using the triangles here to show the roles, but this can definitely just be between two people. Or as ACA points out, this can be about two people in a place, or what do you say, people, places, or things? Because places and things can triangle us in too. And for sure our kids. How many times have our kids triangled in, or we've triangled them in to take pressure off of the conflict? A lot of us grew up in a home where we had to be in the middle between our two parents. And when we grew up, we projected that out into the world and had all kinds of triangles going. So we have choices now in recovery to move up to co-commitment. When I saw this map, I got so excited, and I got excited because of my life review and my near-death experience. I just told you a little bit about my life review this morning. I want to tell you a little bit more because that was 32 years ago, and I realized 5 years ago when we started writing this book that this is what I've been looking for. Since my life review, I have been trying to explain the way God and I re-experienced my life so that the significant others, the other people in my life, and I could have that kind of a relationship. In fact, while we were writing this book, I wrote another book, and that's the one I talked about this morning called The Natural Soul, because this book has a lot of content explaining the map. And this other book that I was writing at the same time are really stories about how we're living in level 2 and level 3 with each other and our families, our kids. So The Natural Soul is a much softer explanation in story form. In my life review, I saw all the chaos and all the violence of my childhood. But at the same time that I saw it, I had this energy wrapped around me and holding me to the point where we became one. And in this oneness that I felt, and I'm not the only one. When I'm telling you this story, I've interviewed over 100 people who have had the same kind of experience, a sense of oneness with a higher power. I was able to see my life through higher power's eyes too. If I would have just been seeing this on my own, I don't think I would have been standing here today. I think it would have just blown me into the universe. But to have something like that wrapped around me and holding me up gave me that whatever I needed to not dissolve. But together, we re-experienced all the conflict and all the triangles. But I also felt my mother, and I felt my father and my brother, and then my boyfriend who went on to become my husband. I felt what they were feeling too. And I'm not saying that I was ready to forgive anybody, but I'm saying that I got a lot of information about where they were coming from. And so when I came back from that, I wanted to share that. I wanted to cure us all. You know, I was a good adult child. I was going to bring all this information back. And they thought I had lost my mind. But what had happened was I was shown what happens when we become empowered. What happens when we motivate the people that we love by just being empowered ourselves. No, I can't tell my kids how to act. They're adults, and they've got to have their own pain to find out how to choose differently. But I can be empowered in front of them. I can act like a whole healthy person. And eventually, they're going to want to know what I've done. You know, they might not get it right away, but after a while, my peacefulness rubs off. And one of my three kids is asking questions all the time now. He's catching it. And so is his wife. So I can become the motivator, or I can be the nurturer, which I've always loved doing anyway. But this isn't a healthy way. This isn't in a codependent way. And what I'm doing is I'm nurturing them to become empowered. So that's stage 2. Now, stage 3 is possible. Charlie and I have lived in stage 3. We keep coming down to 2. Occasionally we slip down to 1. But we try to stay up. If we stay up in 3 and we slip, at least we're only slipping down to 2. Here's 3. It's when we get to the point we're inviting and trusting, call it Holy Spirit, call it Ruach HaKodesh, call it higher power, whatever you want to call it. There is something that can't be described. It's a mystery. It's just hanging around waiting for us to invite it in. It's always been with us, but it can't intervene until we invite it. So 3, co-creator, is where we're inviting and trusting that this is happening. If we trust it, it's there. If we invite it, it can move in. And these terms, which are just nouns, suddenly become action words. The nurturer becomes love and expansion. Can you imagine dealing with your kids, your adult kids, with just love? There's no side reasoning for any of it. It's just loving them where they're at. And the motivator is movement. You see it happening. You see it working. And then the empowered self just melts into creativity because we're co-creating our life with our higher power. Now, the 4th level, which is unity, I think that's where I was in my near-death experience. And I don't think that happens very often. However, when we were writing the book, I had all of a sudden this young man appear, 15 years old, who had the experience in this reality of helping a good friend heal. And when they came out of it, the good friend said to him, "Christ was in you, and Christ healed me." So I interviewed him, and it's like 5 or 6 pages, or I would read it to you, of this profound innocence of a 15-year-old describing what it was like to have the Christ energy coming through him. Yeah, and those are the 4 levels. Are there any questions thus far? I've covered a lot of ground. Okay. Yeah.
I missed this morning.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
I missed this morning part of, you were talking about your review, your life review.
Life review.
I just hope I didn't miss.
Okay, life review, to get into it a little bit deeper. It's a sad story. You know, the first 32 years, I watched it happen again, and I just kept going, no wonder, no wonder. And that meant, no wonder I am the way I am. Look at what was done to me. I was abused a lot as a child, physically, emotionally, certainly spiritually, by my mother and then my brother. And my father just kind of looked the other way. And I saw this whole thing all over again. But every time I said, no wonder, this energy that was holding me held me tighter. And there was no judgment at all. Because I could feel the pain that I created in other people's lives, I was judging myself. I knew suddenly when I was hurting somebody else. But at the same time, when I had been very loving, I could feel the love that I was responsible for. So Ken Ring, one of my colleagues, calls this the cosmic, what did I say, cosmic? I'm going through a mind dump right now. Equalizer. This is the cosmic equalizer. As we're dying, 20% of people who have near-death experiences have a life review. And they all talk about that God wasn't judging them, but they were feeling the pain that they had created in other people's lives. And we had one guy that was a mafia hitman. You want to hear a life review. You know, completely turned him around, which was interesting because his wife left him. She liked him better before. And the mafia let him go, and he's been doing selfless service ever since. So these life reviews are so profound because they show you what's going on. And I came back from that.
Were you ill?
Yeah, I had a spinal operation and nearly died. I couldn't tell my family. Nobody would have understood this back then. I did see a psychiatrist, and he tried to give me antidepressants. So I gave up on that for a while, and I just went back to school, became a respiratory therapist, and this is what's evolved, is we've been writing books now. Yes?
I have a question about, actually two. The first one, what do you do, what practice do you do, or what do you open to move yourself from level 2 to level 3? And then when you're in level 3, how do you feel inside? But I'm more interested in the first question about what you do to, yeah.
How do we get to level 3? Let me turn this off. Level 3, you got it on your page, that's why I'm turning it off. Does anybody want me to keep it on the overhead? Okay. Okay, level 2 is the way I just read Sandra's story. At the moment that we're about to explode or walk out or whatever it is that we usually do when there's a conflict, stop for a moment, take a deep breath, and say, I have choices. I don't have to react the way I used to react. Reactions are over now. There are choices here. I can go walk around the block and discharge some of this nervous energy. And usually when I'm walking around the block, I'm taking it back to when I was a kid, and this is really about when such and such happened instead of when Charlie just insulted me, because Charlie wasn't trying to insult me. I just was triggered because maybe somebody in my family used to use that line. You know, so we have choices between 1 and 2. Between 2 and 3, it's so simple. It's called help. Just think of higher power and ask for help. And what happens if you're open to it, if you invite higher power in and you trust that it's there, it happens. It is amazing how this works. Just imagine if this room was just filled, which I think it is, you know, and we're just saying help. And it says, okay, I'm here. And things usually happen, I've watched this over and over again, especially with my adult married children, where if I would have gone in fist clenched, determined for them to understand what I'm trying to tell them, it would have been a disaster, right? So I pull back and I say, help. And I don't say anything, but somehow, whether it's a TV show or a movie that we're going to watch or somebody walking by saying something or a billboard, somehow it comes up. And it comes up in a way that's gentle. And I watch my kids, I'm using my kids now as the example, I watch them taking it in and discussing it with me. They might even ask me their opinion, and it's like, whoa, this is great stuff. So that's how it happens. It's a simple invitation, and it can be as simple as help. It's hot in here?
Should we? Yeah, it is hot.
Okay, good, thanks. Who else? Somebody have a question back there?
Well, I was just going to say, so going from step three to three with that, what's going from three to four then?
What's going from three to four?
From two to three.
Three to four. Okay. Boy, you guys are great. I knew you'd be like this. Three to four. No, you don't want to have a near-death experience. It's like getting hit over the head with a 2x4. First of all, four is so hot to hold on to that what we need to do is really heal our egos. We really need to get into that false self and release all this stuff, okay? But the difference between three and four is really semantics. In three, we're co-creating. So higher power is still a separate entity, and we're a separate entity, and we're partners, okay? In four, if we've taken care of our ego so we don't move into ego inflation or a spiritual bypass, in four, if we've healed enough, there is no separation between us and God anymore. We are one. And we are one. Remember I showed you that map this morning? That true self, and higher power are one being called the sacred person. And we really can live like that. Not all the time. You know, there's still junk that happens on this planet. I mean, it's not easy living here, especially right now with what's going on. But if we turn off the television and stop reading the newspapers because that's all junk from the media trying to control us. And we realize that in a lot of ways we have been mind-controlled or brainwashed. And let that go and keep asking higher power to come in. We can live our lives in those higher levels. And that's what's going to heal the world. You know, not a new president. Who else has any questions, please?
I have a semi-unique situation. I have raised some kids, and now I'm going around the second time, and I have a 9-year-old and a 5-year-old, and I'm trying to practice detachment and serenity, and I'm told by my wife, who's not in program, that this shows I don't care.
Wow. I can't answer as far as your relationship with your wife goes, but I can't answer from Charlie and my experience of raising one of our grandchildren for 2 years, okay? Our daughter found out she was having a baby, and the father at that time did not want to have any part in it, or she didn't want to have him in any part of it. I don't know the whole story anymore. But we offered for her to come and live with us, and we would help her get through it. And when we invited her to come, and this is before we started writing this book, but it was like a prequel to writing this book, because we told each other that what we were going to do was, you know, team do this together and asking God to help us through this, because at our age already, did we really want a newborn baby in the house? But we weren't going to let her do it on her own if she wanted the help. So she moved in, and for 2 years, I mean, it was wonderful. We called him our little guru, and he taught us so much about our inner child. I mean, we used to follow him around outside, the innocence, the spontaneity, the curiosity of a 2-year-old is just amazing. I mean, he taught us some of these traits because we didn't get to have them when we were a kid. And we kept saying over and over again, this is our chance to have a happy childhood. Nicholas is teaching us how to be a happy kid. And when he was 2 years old, she announced she had saved up enough money, and she moved back to Colorado, which is where we're going when we leave here. And so she was gone, and we were heartbroken. Well, you know, first level, could have jumped in there and tried to control her. Could have jumped in there and, you know, we can help you, you shouldn't go, blah, 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 blah. You know the old stories of control. We just started praying and asking God to help us through it. And what that did for us was, yes, it was painful to let them go, but we didn't suffer. There's a difference between experiencing our emotional pain and suffering. Suffering is when we resist our pain. By keeping ourselves in level 2 and level 3, we were able to experience our pain. And remember I talked this morning about bittersweet? It was bittersweet because there was movement. And it took 3 weeks before we could really calm down. And then within another couple months, we went to visit them. And then within another year, she met and fell in love with a wonderful guy who's a great father to Nicholas. And, you know, it's like it's a happy story now. They've got 4 kids. And they're so happy together. He's a neat guy. So we experience this through level 2 and level 3 by being a team. You know, I don't know if trying to get our mates to understand what recovery was if they don't want any part of it is feasible, but I think that working with our mates with this kind of humility chart and telling them it's time to team live instead of you being on one point of the triangle and me being on another point, and either these 2 kids being the 3rd point of the triangle, or the bigger house, or the new car, or whatever it is that's coming in to create conflict, showing them this plan of moving up into co-commitment, where we're committed to trying to work things through without getting into conflict. And when we do move into conflict now, conflict is different than it used to be, because we're not out to blame the other one. So maybe that could help you. I don't know. Somebody gave me a question this morning that I also wanted to answer, if I can find it, where she said... here it is. I don't want to open up a can of worms that doesn't exist. Could reading literature on incest survivors benefit someone who was only emotionally incested? As in Daddy's little girl, and it's fortunate that he left when he did. I'm fairly sure if he would have stayed, the physical would have happened. And I thought about this for quite a while. And you know, as a therapist, I have tried to read a lot on incest and what it means, so I can understand my patients better. And I've done workshops on it. My abuse was physical, not sexual, but I want to understand it. If you're in recovery and you haven't had incest, I don't know why you would want to read about it unless you know somebody who has been and you want to understand them better. But what I would suggest is go back to the model that we always tell our group members and our individual patients, and that's that you're in the driver's seat. You know intuitively what's good for you and what's not. And what we recommend is that recovery go at your own speed. It's like driving a car. You know, you have your foot on the accelerator, and you can go fast for a while if you want. But if it starts to feel uncomfortable, take your foot off the accelerator. If you need to, put your foot on the brake. And if you really need to, pull over to the side. This way, we're learning more and more about what's healthy for us. We're learning how to be a good parent to ourselves. So the woman who wrote this question, I would say, dialogue with your own inner parent. What is your own inner parent telling you? I think one of the most important leaps in recovery, in later recovery, is learning how to parent ourselves. We never had a model when we were kids for what parenting is supposed to be. Now's the time to figure it out. We tried really hard with our kids so we wouldn't give them the same childhood we had. Well, now it's our turn to figure out how to parent ourselves. What does that mean?
On your earlier talk this morning, you said you mentioned something about being behind yourself and observing yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, what's the difference between disassociating in a negative way and doing that? Because you said sometimes, like, you pull back so that you don't experience all the pain. But I'm wondering, like, where's the boundary between right. that being healthy and unhealthy?
Right. Okay. When we dissociate, we lose most of what's going on. We numb out. You know, we can be gone completely. And then we come back when it's over. When we're being a witness or an observer self, this is a higher kind of evolutionary thing where we're witnessing and watching what's going on, but we're not hooking in. Nobody's triggering us. Nobody can push our buttons because we've moved back. We've moved back. We're sitting here, and the drama is going on. And instead of getting involved in the drama and going back to all the old patterns, we're kind of observing it. It's hard. It's hard in the beginning. What gets us there is meditation. In meditation, we practice this when there's nobody trying to hook us in. There's nobody trying to push our button. So it's an observation of what's going on, but we still know what's going on. We're just not getting hooked in. Okay.
I have just a tiny comment and then a question. It occurs to me, I don't know if you, in your work, you looked up the etymology of humility and the H-U-M and the human and so on, and you know that there's probably some roots there in terms of understanding our own humanity mm-hmm, in that. Mm-hmm. But my question is, one word we hear so much and use so much is trust. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it occurred to me that to ask you maybe to try to unbundle that a little bit, because I come from an Irish heritage, so we're naturally and notoriously reticent, probably untrusting in the sense of keeping family secrets and so forth. But on the other hand, you know, they have an expression today, oh, that's more information than we needed, meaning please don't be sloppy in your sharing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, really, what do we mean when we say learn to trust? It's not an indiscriminate process, and it's a two-way process. So mm-hmm. what, could you, like, refine what you mean?
Well, this is just my experience with trust and my observations in watching groups as far as trust goes. And trust is a process. It is not an event. I mean, did any of you trust when you were a child? Could you trust your family? No. So we grow up. How are we going to trust? I know in my first marriage, I completely trusted him. I just gave it all away because I didn't know how to trust. So, okay, this is my decision. I'm trusting you. Bad move. Red flags all over the place. But no, I didn't have to look at the red flags because I trusted. Okay, after a 23-year marriage and a life review and starting to grow and being accused of changing. That was the big crime. I got out. And here I was out in the world for the first time. I mean, I went from my parents' house to my husband's. I'm out in the world for the first time. What is trust, anyway? Well, I learned trust is something that happens over time. It's a process. And once I start learning how to trust somebody, I want them to come through for me. And if they don't, I have to make a decision. You know, they've made their decision. I have to make my decision. And to me, trust happens over many, many, many years. I'm not giving myself away until I know for sure that I can trust the other person. And I expect the same from them as far as I go. I'm going to earn their trust over time. So that's my idea on trust. Does anybody else have any more on trust that you want to share with us?
Hi. I was at a Christian retreat a couple weeks ago, and the topic was trust one night. And there was a quote by George MacDonald saying that, which states, "It is a greater compliment to be trusted than to be loved." And I think that said it all to me, that is, it's the utmost importance, I think, in this
trust.
Whole process.
And, you know, while I'm walking over there, I want to add that trusting ourselves is just as tough as trusting somebody else. And the way I've learned to trust myself is when something happens, I have to evaluate if I'm giving myself away to the other person. Have I sacrificed me to keep things peaceful? How can I learn to trust myself if I'm sacrificing myself? And it's a good question to ask ourselves when we get into a conflict. How willing am I to give myself away in this? To become codependent. Yeah.
Trust has always been a hard one for me because I've tend to project it into the future. I once had a psychotherapist define trust as predictability, like I trust the, you know, day to follow tonight and whatnot. Dealing with people, there is no predictability. And the only way, within certain odds, I'm sure. I mean, some of you people could probably predict significant others like clocks, but I can't with my significant mother.
Significant mother or significant other?
Boy. Freud lives.
Yeah.
The thing that I find about it that makes trust possible is that I only need it in the present tense. Mm-hmm. I don't have to worry about whether I'm going to trust tomorrow if I'm going to trust now. So I make my decisions, my choices now, and that's all the trust I need.
Yeah, thank you. Brian, another good point, too. We adult kids are either living in the past all the time, feeling guilt, shame, what else? Guilt, shame, fear, anger, whatever, from the past. Fear comes in the future, too. So we're either living in the past, feeling all those painful feelings because we know those feelings so well, we might as well just stay with them, or leap into the future and be so fearful about what's going to happen, right? So we can't get into the now. And this is where the gentleman just made a nice point about trust is in the now. Everything is in the now. If we're in the future being fearful, or if we're in the past feeling guilty, we've dissociated. Because the only thing there really is the now, this moment, this present moment. And when I came back from that near-death experience, I knew that, and it blew me away. Because time changed. My perception of time changed. And I bet for a lot of you, as you're healing, your perception of time is changing because you're getting to stay in the now a lot more. And in the now, there's no linear time. In the now, there's a vertical line. Okay, we're in the now, and higher power is holding one hand, and our feet are planted firmly in the ground, and we're experiencing a spiritual reality instead of a linear sequence, because we're staying right here, right now. What a difference. You know, that's, like I said this morning about the little acorn becoming the giant oak. When we heal ourselves, when we become a good parent to ourselves, we're giving that acorn all it needs to grow now. We're becoming our true self. We're becoming as grand as the oak tree. So we've got our roots planted firmly in the ground. We're grounded. But at the same time, we're spreading our branches up to meet the heavens. And this may be all metaphor, but it's true, too. I got to see a lot of nodding heads. Okay, I think we have time for a couple more questions. Walk forward while I'm walking back. Excuse me.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment. One thing I've learned in life is I can trust someone in a relationship all I want to, but they are still going to do what they're going to do.
Right.
And so what I do is I have a boundary where I trust them, and then it's up to them if they're going to betray themselves or me or whatever. But I do what I can do, but, you know, then they have to decide if they're going to do what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm. Right, because we know it. We're powerless over everybody else. The only one we have power over is ourselves. Okay.
I just want to say that, you know, I have a hard time letting my kids, they're teenagers now, wanting to go out in the world more. And, you know, I just think the world's not safe, and I just speak fear of the world. And it's the only times I can ever, like, really get over it is if I just tell myself that I trust my intuition to tell me when I need to not let them go somewhere. Or so that's kind of helped me. But
yeah,
if you could help me figure out more how to feel
okay.
Safe in the world.
Okay, teenagers is like walking on a tightrope. Having raised three myself, the first rule that I would have if I was raising teenagers again is when they start driving, they cannot drive in a car with other teenagers. You know, they can drive in a car with other adults, but teenagers together in a car is like Russian roulette. that's straight across the board, and I think there are more and more states that are looking at making laws when it comes to kids driving. The rest of it, there's a fine line between giving our kids the message that we can't trust their abilities to take care of themselves. There's a fine line between that and our intuition waving a flag and saying this isn't safe. So I think that every individual situation has to be looked at. And I can tell you, after being married to Charlie for 13 years, that if I had it to do over again and we were raising kids, I would listen to what he's saying about the safety of the kids as much as I would listen to my own intuition. Because I think we women, and I'm sorry if I'm saying something that's not right here politically, but I think that we err on being too cautious, and the guys have a better hold on what's safe and what's not safe for the kids, especially the boys. You know, I would trust his ideas when it comes to the boys more than mine. Okay. I don't know if that helped or not. Okay, one more over here, and then I want to read you a fairy tale.
This is a few years ago, but my grandson was going into the Air Force. And so I said to him one day, "Do you believe in God, honey?" And he said, "Oh, I'm kind of neutral on the subject." And I said, "Well, I just wanted you to know that he exists." And I said, "He's going to be interested in your welfare. And so the only way he's going to let you know what he suggests for you to do to take care of yourself is to give you a want." And he thought about it for a minute, and then he said, "Well, you know what?" He said, "I think that's happened for me." He said, "A couple of times now I've been driving too fast down the street, and something says you better slow down, and I do, and sure enough, there was a traffic cop around the corner."
So God helps with speeding tickets. The parking lot angel. Yeah, I've called on that angel before, and it's worked. What I want to do is share with you in closing. Are there no more questions? Is that a, what is that? Do you have a question?
I equate the presence with intimacy. Is there some way I can loosen that a little bit? The present is too intimate for me.
Being in the present with somebody is too intimate because you're going to be real. Mm-hmm. We didn't talk at all about being real.
In the world, not with another person, but just, yeah, with other people.
With other people, being in the world, being in the presence, so you kind of dissociate when you're with other people instead of being real. Can you say more about that? No? Can I just guess? Are you afraid that they're going to... they're going to think something about you that you don't want them to know? Yeah, I went through that too. That's the beginning or the middle of recovery. If people find out what I'm really like, they're not going to like me, right? So I'm just going to stay out of that completely. Isn't it amazing when we find other people in recovery who like us for who we are? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you come to the Women's ACA group?
No.
I would highly recommend you start doing that because there's such acceptance in ACA, and there's something very special about the women's meetings. Okay, you'll find out that there's other women that feel just like you do. And that's really cool to find out there's other women that feel just like we do. Okay, when I wrote The Natural Soul, and incidentally, if I don't get a publisher, this proposal and the whole thing is done is at 20 publishers, and I'm waiting to hear. So I'm hoping one out of the 20 is going to take it. But if you check our website by next summer, and if I don't have an announcement on our website about who's publishing it, that means it's not getting published. You've got my email address. Email me, and I will email you back the whole manuscript. Because I want this to get out, with or without a publisher. The publishing industry has really changed. But what I did at the end of the book, it's a very short book, but it's about being real, and it's about being playful, and it's about living in those higher levels. So I wrote a fairy tale to all of our child within, and I'd like to just read it to you now. I know you're going to be doing something after this, but this is kind of like a bedtime story for your child within. It's called Eternal Circle of the Soul. Once upon a time, a long, long time ago, before you and I were born, I was a little spark of light, a twinkle in God's eye. I got the news one day that I was to report again down here for another stint. Wait a minute, of course, wait a minute was just a figure of speech, because there is no time when you're a twinkle in God's eye. There is no time in eternity. Wait a minute, I said, I don't want to do that again. I always wind up getting knocked around. This human business is no piece of cake, you know. God smiled, and a tear formed in God's eye, which washed me out. I rolled down God's cheek, and God caught the tear in God's hand and held it up to see me. You're right, God said. It's not too good where the humans are, but we want them to remember that they are like you and like me. They need to remember that they are God and light, too. You need to go down there and help them remember. All right, I winced, but am I going to have to forget again who I am like I always do? Can I skip that part, please? No, God said, but I can offer you something a little different this time. You can have a peaceful life, even a happy life, as soon as you remember. It might take a while, but always choose the highest good, and I'll lead you to peaceful, happy times. How will I know the highest good? I asked. Just say to yourself, what would God do? And I promise you, I will answer. Just listen very carefully to the softest voice within. What a deal, I whined. I don't want to go back. I get so lonely. God got another tear in God's eye again because I talked about being lonely. God wiped the tear with God's other hand, and we both saw another twinkle. It was you saying, I don't want to leave, God. Put me back. God looked at you and said, you need to be human again. Oh, no, you said, not again. Do I have to forget who I am and all about you again? And I get so lonely. It's not easy being human, you know. None of the others really understand yet what being human means. God smiled and then said to you, always pick the highest good, and you will find yourself fast. And when you remember me, ask for this. And God took both hands and put them together so both tears became one. We were the brightest twinkle God had ever seen. And God laughed a big laugh and said, all right, my bright twinkles, you are going off now separately to try being human again. And when you remember to always pick the highest good, I will help you to remember yourself and me. And I promise you that if you do that, it will make two tears in my eyes come together, and then you will find each other and be the brightest beam of light. Oh, this is going to be good. And God smiled again. It seemed like that was eons ago, but here we are, together again. God kept God's promise. And it took us a little while to figure it all out, but occasionally when you look in my eyes, there are two tears that become one because I look back into yours and I can feel God's smile in my heart. I wish all of you this experience over and over again. I hope you find your soul family now, in this lifetime. I wish you peace in your hearts and the vision that comes from seeing through God's eyes, the eyes of our sacred soul. Thank you.